As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine, and today we've got a special episode in which I spoke to Paul Smith, the frontman, lead singer extraordinaire of the English band Maximo Park. Now, many of you who are my age will be familiar with Maximo Park. They're a great band of the indie genre, I suppose you would call, but with wide-ranging influences, I think. Fantastic music. They have a new album out in February called Nature Always Wins, which they were kind enough to send me, and I've been listening to it pretty much non-stop for the last few weeks. It's great. It's really, really good. So if you're a fan of Maximo Park, or if you're a fan of indie music, then you should probably listen to this album. It's really, really, it's really fantastic. So we talk about that a little bit, but Paul is also a huge, great big football fan, was a striker as a player in his youth. And I think that he still plays seven-a-side occasionally now as well. So we talk about that relationship between football and music, something we've touched on in a few other recent episodes. We talk about his dad, who wasn't, you know, really a huge football fan, but did attend games with him. His experiences as a young person attending football games, and the relationship, you know, now between football and finance as well. Paul, as a Middlesbrough fan, describes himself as an easygoing neutral as it relates to Premier League games, and it sounds like he watches a game a day. So he's a bit of a fanatic, which is great. And I found it to be a delightful conversation. So thanks to Paul for participating. This is, I know we've done a couple of music ones recently. This is sort of the third and final one for now as part of a small little mini series. And you'll probably notice we've been on a bit of a break from talking about the football. That's largely because lots of people have been on holiday. Christmas is coming up. The festive calendar is a little too chaotic for us to be able to cover in any depth or be able to keep up with. Basically, by the time we are able to record an episode, there's already been another game. So it's a bit problematic for us at this time of year. So we're away for the rest of this week and Christmas week and for the week after. But as of January, we'll be back and we'll be talking about the football with Seb and Alex and some guests. So we look forward to doing that as well. And I'll be back at the end of the episode to wish you all happy holidays and to say a quick farewell. But for now, let me remind you that if you are still looking for gifts for this year, if you've realised that the stuff you've purchased you can no longer take with you due to travel restrictions, or perhaps you're in London on your own at Christmas or any of the other Tier 4 areas, something that might perk you up is that you can get a buy one gift one deal on a subscription to The Athletic, which is my favourite kind of gift. As I said before, it's like buying concert tickets for someone. They get a gift, but also you do too. And that's the best kind of gift. So if you're interested in football and you want to read the wonderful array of work that The Athletic has available, you can do so and get something good out of it by giving a subscription or gifting a subscription to someone else, as well as you getting your own for the price of one. So visit theathletic.com/TIFO to participate or partake in that benefit, as Paul Smith from Today says that he has done. Not the buy one, gift one deal, but he's a subscriber, which is cool as hell. So, for now, I shall leave you in the cool hands and the very warm embrace of Paul Smith of Maximo Park.
Just wait for the very loud siren to
yeah. I'm up in my attic away from my four-year-old daughter, who's quite excitable at this time of year.
Right, I was going to ask actually if you had kids, because I've been listening to the new album, which I really really love, by the way. I've pretty much had it on non-stop since your promoter sent it to me, but it sounds, I don't really know that much about your life, but it sounds like a lot of the songs are written for or written about your kids.
Yes. Yeah. No, that is that's the funny thing. We've written the album and you know, you want to write it for everybody, but you're also, you know, you're trying to write about yourself, and that's certainly for in our musical life, that's something that we've aimed for. And, but yeah, you don't want to exclude anybody. And, you know, I didn't know I was going to have kids, and there's lots of people I know without kids. And you try and, you know, write about parenthood, but also you don't want to alienate people and make it too insular. So I'm glad you've picked up on it, but that you still, you know, it's just there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I was thinking about that when I was listening to it. I was going to ask whether that is something that you think about. I don't have kids, and I didn't feel isolated from it. So hopefully that's a good thing. Also, because I was thinking, like, a lot of the songs, they feel like, well, not all of them, but some of them feel like love songs, even if they're about your kids. And like that, it struck me that you know, structurally, poetically, works almost entirely the same. Doesn't really matter whether it's a romantic interest or if it's familial love.
Yeah, I mean, even when we first started writing songs, I tried not to have too many he's and she's in it, and I just don't like closing people off, but I don't like wishy-washy, bland songs. So it's it's a kind of fine balance, I suppose.
Yeah. So presumably you grew up as a football fan, Paul?
I did. Yeah. Fairly obsessed with football, if you ask people who are around me. Generally, you know, like the other day, for example, it was the Sheffield United against Man United Thursday night match, after two other days and of watching football, and you know, there was other games on, and I said to my wife, I've only actually watched a fraction of the football that's on. even though I've been watching a game a night, you know, I didn't watch the 6 o'clock matches. I didn't say that to her, but that, you know, we put our daughter to bed at 7, and obviously, you know, you have your tea and family time and all that kind of stuff. And I was just saying, you know, just so you know, I could be watching more. And my wife likes football. That's the funny thing. But I'm the kind of person who's just scrolling through the BBC Sport app on the bus, or, you know, trying to find, if I'm away on tour, I'm trying to find an Irish bar somewhere in Luxembourg, trying to find whatever's on, just to get kind of have that contact. And especially being a Borough fan, you know, I feel like that allows me the flexibility to be a complete neutral when it comes to the, you know, the Premier League most of the time, since Middlesbrough haven't been there for a while. I'm the kind of classic neutral. I build up little narratives in my mind, which allows me to think, you know, whatever the result, it'll be great. You're like, I was watching the Man United against Leeds game yesterday, and you know, I was thinking, well, if Leeds win, it'll be funny because Man United are, you know, so up and down and everybody's on their backs. But also, you know, everybody's talking about Leeds being this incredible team that's come up and swept the Premier League out of its way, which isn't necessarily true. certainly statistically. And I just thought, you know, it'd be really funny if they get thumped. And then if it's a three or four all draw spectacular game, again, I go home happy. So even though I'm at home already. I am the sort of person who, I mean, I've got an athletic subscription. I'm the sort of person who is listening with my ear to the ground for transfer rumors and then kind of, you know, thinking, well, if that happens, then so-and-so will move on here. And, you know, it's as football, especially with the kind of coverage and the media coverage that there is these days, you can go deep. And a lot of, I tried fantasy football one year, but I don't think I talked to my family very much. So it was time to knock that on the head.
Have you found that this year you've sort of engaged with it more or used it more as a form of escapism from, I mean, what is, you know, maybe a lot of monotony most of the time as a result of the pandemic, or is this just normal behavior for you?
It is sadly normal. And the fact that it's now on, you know, on different channels all the time because there's no crowds, I'm actually watching more of it. You know, before I could justify it, especially since having a daughter, you know, I used to go to the pub on a Sunday just by myself because a friend of mine I used to watch the football with every Sunday, moved back home after university. I don't mind watching football if it's a good match, in a kind of solitary way with a pint of Coke and crisps at halftime. I'm a sad individual, it has to be said.
No, it sounds pretty good to me. I think that's fine. So what was the first game of football you ever went to?
It was Middlesbrough at home to Watford, and it must have been, I think, 1989, possibly. Maybe 1990, I'm not sure. I used to listen to it a lot on the radio because my dad's not massively into football or anything. And we didn't, you know, it's obviously very expensive to go to games, more so these days. So I didn't really go to the games. I was kind of too young to go by myself, so I would just listen. I caught the bug in the playground playing football, and everybody was talking about Middlesbrough because they had the local team. I'm from a small town called Billingham, and you know, I could have supported Billingham Synthonia. And again, if my dad had been more into football, I might have been, you know, going to non-league games every now and then. I'll go to a non-league game up here, and just, you know, if there's a spare Saturday. At that point, it was just listening to TFM or BBC Tees or whatever it might have been, just broadcasting the matches. And the Borough were actually they were right in the thick of administration when I first became kind of aware of the Borough. And it was 1986, I think, and the gates to Hull to Ayresom Park had been locked, and it was always on the telly. And then as I got a little bit older, I started listening to the games, and we got promoted to the old Division One after a playoff battle with Chelsea. And it was the old format where the about to be relegated team would play the about to be promoted team in a sort of battle to the death, which we should probably have more of these days.
Well, I think they wanted to bring it back. That was part one of the suggestions of the Project Big Picture, I think, was that kind of playoff loser versus winner.
That's interesting. Yeah. That's interesting because there was a lot at stake, as there always is with these things. You know, it's often called the Premier, the one to get it. The Premier League is always supposed to be the most lucrative match around the world to get up. And obviously, yeah, listening at home, being new to football, not even necessarily thinking about the monotony of day-to-day life that we find ourselves in the Championship. Although that's changing at the moment. We're having a good season at the moment. But yeah, it was very exciting time to be a Borough fan. But the first game I went to, we lost 2-1, and I'd actually won the tickets on the local radio station by answering a question fastest on the phones.
Wow.
And so it was super exciting just to be at the ground, but also to have won the competition. And, you know, I borrowed my cousin Peter's suit to go into the lounge. I was in the Dickens lounge. Dickens was a large DIY store, local DIY store that sponsored Middlesbrough. And My dad and I, we were entered into a sweep for the first scorer, and we got Simon Coleman, who I think was the left back. And we thought, well, you know, this is bad luck. And sure enough, Simon Coleman scored the first goal, won the sweep. Middlesbrough lost. Again, lessons were learned for the future. And the, after the game, the Borough, we were supposed to meet the Borough players, but none of them wanted to come and meet anybody because they'd lost in a disappointing midweek game against Watford. And whilst kind of just about to leave, I think, after having our vol-au-vents or whatever, bumped into Colin Cooper, one of the nicest people in football, who was injured that day, and he had his club suit on and was drifting around. And I got a photo with him, chuffed in me sort of ski jacket at the tail end of the early 90s, tail end of the 80s. And it was just, I mean, it was so magical that I still think about the, you know, walking down the cobbles in the center of Middlesbrough. You know, the old Ayresome Park was in the middle of the town, and you know, the floodlights coming on. I still get that kind of, the, again, sad person that I am, I still get that kind of buzz if I'm going to play seven-a-side or whatever, you know, getting on the bus, getting out at your stop and walking down the street, seeing the floodlights come into view, and getting on the AstroTurf and destroying your knees for virtually no reason. And yeah, it's all of that was probably put into place by that first trip.
Mm. Well, I was gonna say, you brought up your dad and said he wasn't not a huge football fan. I wanted to understand that dynamic, if that's all right, because I'm very interested in people going to football with their dads or even their mums, for example. But if he wasn't a huge fan, he was there. He was part of your first experience. Yeah. Has it sort of impacted football? Has it football impacted your relationship with him at all? Did you do any bonding as a result of it, or not?
Virtually not.
Really a big fan. Yeah. So how does that work when you're chatting to other people? Because it's a very common thing, isn't it?
It is. It's strange because my dad actually is more into football now, and especially with all of the games being on at the moment. They don't have Sky or whatever, but you know, I think we've both got access to BT Sport, and he's now WhatsApping me going, "Hey, you're watching this game?" And it's strange how it kind of works out, because he was, you know, if I really, really wanted to go to a game and I'd saved up the money, he would come with us, of course. But our friends, I think my brother's friend, Stephen Dennis, he was well into football. I think his brother was in my year or the year above, and they would both go to the football with their dad. And so I would go along with Stephen Dennis and his dad, and by the fanzine and stuff. So I was just tagging along, really. I would just get sort of dropped off by my mum and dad, get into their car and just go off in the rain or whatever, straight to the ground. And I think my uncle Joe, I think he took me to a couple of games. I think he might have taken me to, there was Stephen Pears's testimonial, our old goalkeeper, and it was against Man United, and Mark Hughes was playing, and I was a big fan of Mark Hughes, being a sort of, I was a striker for the school football team, so that idea of holding the ball up and the kind of unselfish work that Mark Hughes had done. So I had all these kind of conversations with not only my dad when he took me, but also sort of anybody who was going, random people, and also like my auntie Annette and her partner Mickey. They took me along to quite a few games, and my friend Neil had a season ticket with his mum and his sister, and when his sister didn't go for whatever reason, I would go along and sit next to my pal Neil, who I still, you know, still am in touch with about the Borough. And then as I got older, you know, there'd be all sorts of friends. Matt, again, I'm still really good friends with a couple of the lads that I grew up with in Billingham, my friend Ben and me friend Neil, and we'll still go to the games, you know. And living in Newcastle ever since I went to university up here, I've always, you know, cherished that kind of that little trip back, because It's, you know, I would get on the bus. I only learned to drive 4 years ago when my daughter was born. So, you know, I would get on the bus, spend an hour and 20 minutes or whatever on the X10 or on the train. And, you know, it would be so exciting to meet up with me pals. And obviously the whole experience of going to watch a team like Middlesbrough, who are a bit of a yo-yo club, is you know, the results aren't necessarily going to be what you want, but most of the time, when we had Gordon Strachan as the manager, you know, it was hard to watch, and you would go along, and it would be more about what the guy in front of you is saying when he's, you know, swearing his head off about something that, you know, is entirely ridiculous and that you completely disagree with. And, you know, me and me pals will just be sort of looking at each other and laughing, and, you know, getting a Palmo before a mini Palmo before the game, which is a Middlesbrough delicacy, which is kind of slightly cliched now. But all those things are very much about, yeah, kind of building relationships with people and being part of that bigger thing, you know, of a crowd, and everybody's sort of pulling the same way, apart from the guy in front of you who is, you know, booing the best player or whatever. You know, that's one, pretty much the main reason you go, as well as obviously the football. And if it goes well, it just elevates you day and night.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
As you were talking before, I was thinking about a few different like day trips I went on as a child with one of my friends and their parents. And it's a totally different thing, isn't it, than going somewhere with your parents? I imagine like going to the football with, obviously you're with an adult and you're safe and whatever, but that it's not one of your parents adds a level of, I don't know, mystery and risk to it a little bit, which I imagine informed your relationship with that attendance,
yeah,
quite a lot.
Well, you know, we were mostly sat in the sort of family areas, but there was quite a few occasions as well where we were in the old Holgate end, which was the, you know, the proper fans, ultra fans, or whatever you want to call them, hardcore fans. And you would hear all sorts of stories of people going to the toilet in whilst stood up on the back of other people or whatever. And, you know, the violence that we grew up with as a kind of child of the 80s, you know, seeing the sort of different aspects of football hooliganism, and also the kind of the authorities over the top way of managing it, and the kind of the cages that you used to be in with the fences. You know, that's kind of part of the that kind of mystery and edge to proceedings. You know, not everybody who goes to the football is going to be, you know, your pal. it's a wide kind of cross section of football. You know, football fans are a kind of wider cross section, and obviously these days, you know, the higher up you are, the more sort of refined it is, and you know, it's more expensive. It prices a lot of people out. But, you know, growing up and going to see Middlesbrough in a, you know, in a proper old style stadium, and when the crowd would surge forward and you were kind of swaying with the crowd and being younger and seeing the backs of people and trying to find a gap to see the football through. It was kind of amazing and also, yeah, a little bit scary.
Does your dad like music?
My dad loves our music.
Right. Yeah.
Again, he does love music in his own way, and he actually does a lot of dancing. He does kind of this thing called Ciroc, which is a sort of salsa and rock and roll kind of combined. And he's danced at the Blackpool Tower in competitions.
There's no higher honor.
Well, this is it. You know, he's taken it to the next level. Mm-hmm. Which is something that after he's kind of retired, and whilst still at work, but getting older, it's been a good way for him to kind of keep fit. Because when we were kids, I remember he did karate, and me and my brothers ended up doing karate at the same Billingham Karate Club, and I just wasn't into it. You know, I like the kind of discipline of training and, you know, and sport. You know, I love all sorts of sports, and played for my school teams in basketball and football and long distance running and the athletics team and all that kind of stuff. So any sort of sport I'll kind of enjoy. But yeah, I think when we were growing up, yeah, he would be going to karate, and I would just think, I can't do this. There's, you know, it's a bunch of 30-year-old guys who are sweeping my legs and splitting my arms open.
How long did you go for? Did you go for long enough to do one of the belt level up things?
Well,
where you had to do the performance.
Yes, yeah, you do the kata, which was part of the Wado Ryu.
I can't believe you remember these words. I did it too, but I have almost no memory. I know I must have done like three of these events, and I can't remember any of them.
Well, this is it. Yeah, I kind of remember some of the names. Like the sort of neutral stance was called mate, and the roundhouse kick was called a mawashi gari. Oh, and all of these kind of things. This is the thing. I went long enough for it to be embedded in my psyche for both good and bad reasons. As I say, I'll never forget kind of being on the verge of tears so many times, because they would make you do press ups, and I was like 10, and I've never done a press up in my life, and it was not fun. It was really kind of quite grim, and yet some of the people who ran it were really great, and a lot of people, like my cousins, went, and they went right through all of the different belts and stuff. So I did like a couple. So I had a white belt with two tags, and I was just about to go for my green belt, and I was ill, and so I couldn't go to the thing, to the whatever you might call it, the sort of the performance almost where you do your little routine and go through all the motions and pass the exam. And I just never went back. I just said to my mum, I really don't like it, you know? And she said, you don't have to go, son. And I think my dad would have probably been disappointed at the time. Not that I recall that. I was just absolutely relieved to not have to go back to Billingham Forum and the local sports centre and ice rink and do that again. So, but it kind of stood me in good stead, because, you know, when you have fights and whatever at school, which I didn't have loads of fights, because my cousin was really tough, and nobody wanted to have to deal with him. But yeah, you know, the fights that I did have, I just kind of would just block and sort of know all the kind of blocks, and people would just give up eventually.
You never did the mawashi gari, no?
I think I probably tried, and it just looked ridiculous.
That was the best thing about being a kid, wasn't it? I remember I worked on a farm for a bit after I did some work experience at this place, and then I worked there on some evenings and Saturdays for a year or so, and I hated it so much. It was terrifying, and all the animals were terrifying, and I just, you know, I just couldn't adapt to it. And one day my boss would routinely not pay me, and I was about to go and visit my dad in London, and I hadn't been paid for something like 5 or 6 weeks. So my mother was picking me up, and I got her to go in and demand demand my wages, which she did, very kindly came out with, I don't know, £70 or something, which was more money than I'd ever seen before. And I just never went back. I never told them. I never called. I feel like that's the best thing about being a child, just being able to stop, you know, on a...
Oh, yeah. I was a very short-lived paper boy. And I'd wanted to have some extra money for buying records and probably buying tickets to football matches. And it was winter when I started, so it was really dark mornings. Didn't enjoy it. And one morning it was so icy, and I was on my bike, and I came off my bike and just went splat on the floor and sort of limped. This was probably pre-mobile phones, so limped back to our house. And I think the bike had actually buckled one of the wheels. And so my mum drove me round the rest of the route, which was kind of halfway through or whatever. And some people saw me being driven round, and that was that, really. At school, I was mocked as the guy whose mother drove him round his newspaper route. There was a good reason behind it, but it just didn't, you know. I was ready to walk away.
When was the last time you just stopped something?
That's hard to say, because my commitments are all driven towards something that I really love doing.
Yeah. Maybe you've just refined then.
I'll tell you what. The other day, the last video that Maximo Park did, I was in it by myself for the first ever time, because it was a really simple idea of me just climbing up a ladder, a sort of infinite ladder for this song, I Don't Know What I'm Doing, off our new record. And, you know, I look like a little bit of a Wally in the film. You know, I'm supposed to be more and more distressed as I get higher. I was being sort of made up to look like I was in tears and sweating really badly. And I actually was, because when we were filming it, the ladder was at a sort of 45 degree angle, because of the way it had to be filmed, and it wasn't an infinite ladder. So I just had to keep going back and climbing up this ladder, but I had to look as if I wasn't pressing down on it. So I was essentially planking for the whole day whilst climbing up this ladder, which was intense and grueling. And I felt like walking away from that one. I'm meant to be doing, you know, I'm a singer.
What would have happened though, Paul, like if you had just stopped halfway through the day and said, I'm not doing it? The consequences are too much to bear at this age, presumably.
This is the thing. We would have had no video. I would have, a lot of people would have gone home and they'd have got paid, but we wouldn't have got anything from paying thousands of pounds out for this video shoot. And I thought this is maybe too much here. But following on from that, the thing that I stopped doing the other day was we made a little filter for people on Instagram so that they can climb up the ladder themselves. You just do your selfie camera, pop on the filter, and if you open your mouth, you climb up the ladder. It's a bit of festive fun for people over the Christmas break who've got nothing better to do than to scroll through the phones. Somebody from our office I'm telling you secrets now, but somebody from our office had done it to kind of see if it worked properly and to get it online. And so we said, you know, this is a fan has done this video. Check it out. It's you know, use our new filter on Instagram. But they'd actually asked me to do it. And I said, but it'll just look like me in the video. So it won't have, you know, nobody will be able to fathom what's happening.
That one's not been thought through, I don't think.
Obviously, I tried it, and I just looked so stupid. But it wouldn't work. It wouldn't go through. So I didn't send my video of me doing it, and I gave up after sort of 40 minutes. I just thought, you know, is this what Bob Dylan does with his spare time? Just trying to upload Instagram videos of him pretending to climb a ladder. Don't think so.
It's just his Nobel Prize in his spare time, I think, isn't he?
Yeah, he just rakes in his publishing cash.
That's true. I wonder what Bob's doing. I mean, Bob spends, what, it seems like he spends 9 months of every year on tour, doesn't it? I wonder what he's done this year.
It's known as the never-ending tour.
Right,
and yeah. And it is. So, yeah, I'm worried for Bob. No wonder he's, you know, I mean, he mustn't spend much money, really, generally, while he's out on tour playing in arenas and getting all of his, you know, beans on toast made for him or whatever.
I bet he's on eBay all day now.
This is it.
Yeah.
Or did you see that Rolling Thunder review film that was made by Martin Scorsese?
No, I haven't watched it. Is it good? Is it worth watching?
It's brilliant. And I, if anybody's going to watch it and doesn't want to know anything about it, then mute your podcast for 10 seconds. But it's a blend of fact and fiction, which I didn't know before I watched it. And there's like people in this sort of rockumentary that are actors.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
It's incredible. It's like, it's totally, you know, people are getting head up about the crown. Well, you know, they want to check this out. It really is hilarious that he kind of has an almost straight face in it. And he's like, this guy, I used to hate this guy. He was always hanging around. And you're like, you find out later, or at least I did, that this person didn't actually exist. Wow. Bob's just having a laugh. But there's footage of him driving his own tour bus, massive tour bus, which is, again, mildly amusing for people who like Bob Dylan like me.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure he'll be fine. I think he sold his back catalogue the other day, didn't he, for some obscene amount of money. So
he did. He'll be buying a few more tour buses.
Wow, yeah, crazy. Hey, I hear that you, no one told me, I read about it, that you once played football with a man on the run from the law. Do you know what I'm referring to?
I do. I'm amazed. I'm amazed that's you've found that. I didn't want to dob anybody in, but it is pretty much 20 years ago now, so I think I'll probably be all right. But yes, I used to play for... I won't name them, but I used to play for a pub football team in Stockton, and the team was made up of an assortment of students like me, probably two or three of us, because my friend's mum owned or ran the pub, which is how I kind of got involved in it. And, you know, the pub sponsored the shirts, and you'd go back and have a pint after the games. And we were due to play in Port Clarence, which is, you know, it's a fairly rough area as well, I have to say. And we were in our car park, just waiting for everybody to turn up. And one of the players, again, I won't name him, he'd been up to something, and his house had been raided, and it was over the road from the car park. And we were like, oh God, what's happened there? Because there was a few students on the team, but mostly it was people from the area, and some of them were known to engage in criminal activity. Again, I'll say no more. But yes, so this house had been raided. Door was open, had been kind of battered down. And so we were just about to set off, not assuming that our left back wasn't coming. And he just turned up at the last minute with it barefoot, needing some boots and a spare strip. And he said, you know, I'm going to play because my dad lives lives over that other way where you're headed. So just, you know, you give me a lift, I'll play and everything will be all right. And we were kind of astonished. But that was, you know, that was part of, this was not par for the course, but it wasn't that unusual, considering the area that we were in. But so we drove along this kind of long, lonely road out to Port Clarence, and it's kind of an industrial area just near the Transporter Bridge in Middlesbrough. And we were on this long road, very straight, and a police car suddenly kind of turned the corner and was between us in the convoy and the car that this guy was in. And we were just laughing our socks off, just thinking how much he was bricking it at that stage in the game, and what chance it was that a police car would come. Although, you know, again, you know, I think they probably did a fairly regular patrol around there. But it was, yeah, he played, credit to him, and I don't think I ever saw him again.
I was going to say, did he face the music after the game? Maybe. Maybe that's what happened.
I think he did, but we were getting pelted by kids. They were like throwing stones at our keeper behind the net. It was a strange day all round.
One of those games. This is something I want to ask you. I've had a couple of musicians on in the last few weeks. I've asked those people as well, because I'm very interested in the sort of crossover between football and music. When I think about it, I think of my dad, because he grew up in Harlow in Essex, I guess in the 60s and the 70s, and he was, you know, by today's standards, just like a massive weirdo, and he had long weird hair, and he loved Neil Young, and I'm pretty sure he took a lot of drugs, but he also loved football, and was a big Manchester United fan, and he played regularly, you know, way into his adult life as well, obviously at amateur level. And I feel like by the time I was growing up, which was in the 90s and in the 2000s, you sort of did one of those things. You didn't do both of them. And personally, I was into music and I was a bit of a goth. And even though I loved football, I wasn't really accepted by the football people. And as a result, I kind of fell out of love with it for some of my teenage years. And so I wanted to ask you about this. You're about 10 years older than me, I think. But I wanted to ask you about when you were growing up, whether you felt that there was any sort of limitation on what you were allowed to enjoy, or whether at that time, you know, you were a football fan and you were a music fan, and that was all fine.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I can relate that to that tale of not feeling like you fitted in with either bunch of people. I mean, I would say I was definitely more of the arty crowd. You know, I was painting, and that was one of my stronger subjects, and English, you know, reading lots of books. And so, you know, I clearly fitted in more with that crowd, and was diligent at my studies, which not all of my football team were, it has to be said. And so, yeah, when I would hang out with my sort of arty friends, they would have absolutely no interest in football whatsoever and couldn't understand my obsession with it. And when I was, you know, on the bus going somewhere with the football team, everybody else would be like mooning out of the window, and which, you know, was mildly amusing. But I would have my headphones on, and I'd have a music magazine, I'd be reading the NME or whatever. And that kind of marks you out, I'm afraid. And yeah, it was, I think I had definitely had a tougher time, but I was so determined to play for the team because I could play football and I enjoyed it. And, you know, I kept getting picked. I was determined not to let the sort of slight abuse, go, you know, put me off playing. And, you know, going back to what you were talking about earlier with parental roles, my mum would come and watch every game that she could on the touchline at my school when I was playing for Northfield in Billingham, and then she'd come to the odd away match if there was, you know, a friend of mine played for another school. She would kind of come and watch this sort of grudge match between between her and her and the other parents, and you know, again, that was pretty unusual. There wasn't really many mums on the touchline, and so yeah, I was unusual all round, I'm afraid. And so yeah, sometimes on the team bus it'd be like, what are you listening to, you know? And when I used to play for the pub team that I've just talked about, it was, you know, I was known as Hairy Paul because I had long hair, and you know, that was that, really. It was, yeah. You know, you can't fight against these things too much, because you know, it's a bit of a laugh, and the more you act annoyed, the worse it gets. But again, you know, I was, you know, captain of the pub team, and you know, I was the top scorer, and would be a part, you know, a big part of the team. So it was one of those things people couldn't couldn't have too much of a go at me.
Yeah. It must have given you some like social credence, right? Particularly as you got older, because you would have, people would have started recognizing you as cool and also good at football.
Well, yeah, hard to say at Northfield Comprehensive whether that actually happened.
Sure. It's working out now, though.
It's all worked out. But this, yeah. It's funny how football has become, you know, very much a sort of a reasonably hip thing, especially in conjunction with music. So you've got like Soccer AM is a good example where it's, you know, it's music soundtracking the goals, and you know, same with Match of the Day's Goal of the Month or whatever.
There's a Dan film.
Yeah, you know, all there's loads of crossovers, which there weren't really in my day. But there weren't too many crossovers. I don't think. I think the sort of era of football becoming this really glossy product. You know, it was a lot of football fans were kind of ostracized in the years when I was growing up, and that kind of changed just around, yeah, I guess when I was entering my teens, when Sky pumped all the money into the new Premier League, and just watching how that's become the sort of be all and end all is slightly irritating, but also kind of funny, really, you know, the way that it's like biggest, you know, the top scorer in the Premier League of all time, and it, you know, it completely dismisses the rest of football in history, which is weird. And the same with the Champions League, and you know, you wouldn't believe that there was a European Cup before that, or a UEFA Cup before the Europa League, and you know, that those things are, considering football is sort of based on history and loyalty and all these kind of tribal things. It's amazing how that kind of that money and product and big business and money has flipped that a little bit. But it means that it's more acceptable to be into football and music, whereas that wasn't so much of a thing. And I remember even in my school, you know, I remember being in a German lesson talking to a guy about the Beatles, who also was on the football team, a guy called Paul Walton. And people were like, "Oh, you hippies, what are you talking about Beatles for? They're just hippies." And, you know, this is like 1990s, early 90s. It was not the done thing to like the Beatles. And I remember when we first started going to house parties and stuff, and it would be kind of chart music, or, you know, somebody might put on, you know, Mariah Carey or whatever, one of her sort of bigger ballads rather than some of the other stuff, you know? And it was just a weird, you know, that was parties for you. People would put on their favorite music and then everybody would have a go at putting a song on. And, you know, I was definitely in the minority there as well, a little bit more, again, obsessed with music. And perhaps during this podcast, we're coming across the fact that I have some sort of obsessive character. But yeah, music and football and art, you know, drawing and painting, they were the thing, you know, when I like something, I tend to love it and, you know, collect things. You know, I would collect the tickets. I've still got all of my tickets from every concert that I ever went to and every football match I ever went to as well, which again is pretty odd. You know, I'm in my 40s now.
could you do the best of both?
Yeah, I think so. I think when I was a kid, I would often have, when I was probably more of a teenager, there would be concerts on, and it would be on the same night as a big football match, or there would be, you know, I would be playing football, and there would be a concert that I really wanted to go to. And that became quite difficult. And as I've got older, I've taken the concert over the football, usually because my legs have started to give up on me and the football has become less important. But it was, yeah, I mean, I remember actually playing, this is not necessarily that big a dilemma actually, but take that, we're playing the local nightclub, and everybody in the school was going, mostly a lot of all the teenage girls were well into it. But all the teenage boys wanted to go where the teenage girls were going. And they were playing at like a local nightclub and their first sing. I don't even know if they'd had an album out or whatever, but they were massive. And, you know, everybody was getting, you know, getting the hair gel out and all that sort of stuff. And I went to play football in the snow for the school team. And it was like the only time that I think I've, you know, you've played in sort of snowy games, but we had to clear the pitch. And I was like, shoveling snow off the pitch, and somebody was trying to find an orange ball. I think the PE teacher was trying to find an orange ball, but it was, yeah, we were, obviously it was kind of amazing, but obviously the rest of the whole school was at this nightclub having some sort of teenage experience.
Well, no disrespect to fantastic performers. I think you may have made the right decision. I don't know if you regret that nowadays.
No, je ne regrette rien.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what's the best concert you've ever been to?
Oh, that's really difficult because I like so many different kinds of music, and you know, on different days, different ones would pop out.
What if it's just one where you're stood up instead of sat down? Does that narrow it down?
Well, I love sitting down these days, I have to say.
Me too. It's the best. Those are the best kind of gigs where they've got the seats out.
They're great. Yeah.
Oh,
small,
I love them.
Small room, lots of seats. That'll do.
I'll only go to the Barbican. That's it. I know they're comfy.
Exactly. No, that's it. Royal Festival Hall. We played there actually on our last album tour, on the Risk to Exist album tour at the Royal Festival Hall. And, you know, it was amazing because I'd been there to see Tony Bennett, which was, you know, definitely one of my greatest gigs because I've loved Tony Bennett since I was a teenager. Marking me out somewhat from the crowd at school. But I would tape stuff off. He was on the real reason was because he'd had a kind of crossover thing with MTV, and I was well into sort of grunge, and he'd turned up on an awards ceremony, and I think was presenting one of the awards, and I was like, this guy's really good, you know, I love this kind of crooner style, probably because it was slightly antiquated, but I ended up really loving Tony Bennett and listening to his music quite a lot. And just, again, that kind of old school, great American songbook stuff led me into stuff like Ella Fitzgerald and, you know, incredible singers. And the older that he's got, there's this great grain in his voice. And I remember seeing him at me and my wife went to see him at the Royal Festival Hall, and we were one of the youngest people there in our little box, waiting for him to come out with the Ralph Shannon trio. And it was just, you know, I felt like I was kind of watching a piece of history as well, because he's, you know, he was like 80, I think 80 odd when that gig was on. I think he's just had his 90th birthday, I think. And he actually couldn't remember sometimes he couldn't remember a couple of the lines in the songs and stuff. And it was just, it felt so human. But also he's such a great entertainer, and he's done it, you know, thousands and thousands of times before, and it's ingrained into his body, and his memory and all of those kind of things. And just being in this beautiful building that was designed, you know, for the great exhibition of 1951, this beautiful place. When we actually played there, all those kind of things were going around my head. There's like a Steinway in every dressing room, and they had all the posters backstage. So that's one of my favorite gigs because that I've played myself, just because six albums down the line you feel a little bit more relaxed in who you are and what the performance is going to be like. You know that you've got an amazing fan base who keep coming back and, you know, giving you top 20 records and that kind of thing. You feel like there's less to prove in one sense, but in another sense, there's so much to prove because people have seen you on six other album tours or seen you at festivals. And if they keep coming back, you don't want to let them down, which again feeds into maybe something that is inside that kind of Tony Bennett kind of style of performer and entertainer, somebody who wants to put on a show. Another one that kind of stands out might be, we played Glastonbury and we'd done our bit and we watched Neil Young and Bruce Springsteen from a great distance. And it was just incredible because it felt like, again, you know, Neil Young, I've loved since I was a proper, I was like just a teenager and got into Neil Young and dredged up my mum's Neil Young records from a LP collection, and his Harvest Moon record had just come out. And then I went through all of the different permutations that he has on his music, the kind of louder stuff, the quieter stuff, the strange synthy stuff that he did in the 80s, this great, great record Trans, which is just a real outlier.
It's and really so weird.
It is, it's odd. And he's an oddball, you know, he's a true kind of maverick in his own way. And his guitar playing is just immense. So to actually see Neil Young playing a kind of greatest hits, and you've just played again, you know, like my, you know, obviously my dream gigs are, you know, I've done most of them, you know, and to be there on a weekend where we opened Glastonbury and then we in a little tent and then we actually played on the other stage or whatever it was. And just to know that you've done your bit, you've done your best, and to go and watch other people who are doing it and be on the sort of, you know, at the same festival as these people, you know, like Bruce Springsteen had this, it was on the BBC, this kind of famous image, which you could see from quite a distance away of him sweating so much that steam was rising off him in the spotlight. And, and he's got his, he's still, you know, in shape. So this kind of old bloke who's just plowing through these songs with zeal and determination, which is kind of part of the whole Springsteen kind of thing. And you know, that was a good weekend, I would say.
Yeah. Do you know, I've seen Neil Young, I think more times than I've seen any other act. And every single time, it's always outside and always, some kind of massive festival day or something. And I don't know what it is that he's doing, or if they just turn the guitars up a bit louder than they do with everyone else, because he's not hitting the guitar physically any harder, but there's something about the way that he plays. It just, like, there's no other word for it. Like, it just rocks more than any other live act I've ever seen.
Oh yeah.
It's just incredible.
Well, so many people have been kind of influenced by that guitar tone. And you will hear people doing a kind of Neil Young choppy thing, and you'll go, that's the Neil Young guitar sound. And I think he still uses the same amp that he's always used, and he's got like two or three of them, and he's got the same roadie who just fixes them after every gig, and they're just absolutely blown out to bits. But it's this kind of, this 50s probably Fender amp. And he still got his, you know, his classic Gibson that with his whammy bar and all that kind of stuff that he carries around with him. And I read when I was young and didn't really enjoy practicing guitar or you know, dusting it or anything, or keeping it in any particular good condition. I read that he never changed his strings until he had to, and he had like these rusty strings. And so I've used that now as the excuse for never changing my own strings on my electric guitar unless I really have to. And loads of people who I come across who have to deal with my guitars, or, you know, a friend like my friend Paul Rafferty, who's played bass with Maximo Park and was in his own band Hot Club de Paris, plays great guitar player. Every time he would come and stay with me when Maximo Park were practicing a few years ago until I moved and had a baby and all that kind of stuff. And he would always play my guitars and just go, "Paul, man, when are you going to change these strings?" Disgusting. But the thing is, this is going to sound pretty pretty much like I'm defending myself already, but I do have very clean hands.
Well, it's perfect things, for a pandemic.
Things might be a little old and knackered, but the, you know, I could be quite OCD about it. So I think that this, my hands are always clean when I play the guitar. But I've known a few people who haven't changed the strings in my time, who maybe aren't as hygiene happy as I am, and they were pretty grim. So, you know, that's a different thing. That's a different, just so the listeners know.
Well, you know, you said before that you feel six albums in and, you know, your concerts are a lot more relaxed, and that totally comes across in the new album. I think it's like, I genuinely think it's really, really amazing. So thanks for sending it to me, because it's been lovely to listen to. I know you've got to go for dinner now, but it's been very nice to talk to you, Paul. Thanks very much for coming on.
No, my problem, Joe. Cheers.
Well, that was that. I hope you enjoyed listening to today's episode. I very much enjoyed talking to Paul. Great guy. I think you'll agree if you've made it this far in the podcast. And I just wanted to wrap things up by saying thanks so much to everyone for listening this year, 2020. It's been a great year for TIFO. It's been transformational for us who work here. As you've probably noticed from me repeatedly plugging, we became officially part of The Athletic back in April, and everyone's been working exceptionally hard to try and improve TIFO and increase the number of pieces of content that we can release on a weekly basis. We started our State of the Club series. We released our second episode on Chelsea recently, the first one back in September on Arsenal, and that's been really, really fun to do. You know, we've tried to stick true to our original principles as well, and tried to cover a sort of wide array of stuff for what is TIFO's international audience. So if you are a listener to this podcast, regular, or if this is your first one, thank you very much for participating, because obviously it goes without saying, but we couldn't do this without an audience of people who are hopefully interested in what we're producing. We won't be back this week, so I hope any of you who are celebrating Christmas have a very merry time. Those of you who aren't, for reasons of cultural religion, or just that you hate Christmas, that's fine. I hope you have a lovely normal time, normal week. And you probably heard the motorbike there. Sorry about that. And we will be back as of January, where we'll be talking about sensible transfers. Not expecting many teams to buy anyone because of, you know, money and stuff. But hey, that's not going to stop us talking about who they should buy. So we're gonna be doing that, and we'll be very much looking forward to it. So from myself, from Alex, from Seb, from all of the guests who've appeared, from producers Adonis and AD, and from everyone at TIFO and The Athletic, thank you very much. Hope you have a Merry Christmas, or just a normal good week. And we'll be back in 2021, which promises to be another year of all of our lives. So there we go. Thanks very much, and ta-ra for now.